Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundtable of the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this week, five Utahns who rode their ATVs through Recapture Canyon are facing charges for off-road riding on restricted land. How is the legal action playing in rural Utah? Utah Transit Authority tells lawmakers they'll abide by recommendations in an audit. Are legislators taking their word for it? And Governor Herbert says federal officials have assured him a new national monument in Utah won't happen while officials negotiate about public lands policy. So how is that lands process going? All that and Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines coming up after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And today on the program, we have UTA, Recapture Canyon, health insurance, and much more. And joining me this morning, Tribune editorial writer George Pyle is in the studio. George, good morning.
Good morning.
On the reporting side, government reporter Lee Davidson returns. Lee, hi.
Hi.
And environment reporter Brian Mathley is here as well. Brian, good morning.
All right, good day to you all.
And on the phone, health reporter Kristen Moulton is joining us from her home office. Kristen, hi. Hi.
Good morning.
And you can join us, too. If you've got a news story on your mind, you can send your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+. Put your comments on the website sltrib.com. You can also call us live. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Kristen, I'll start with you. The big story on the front page this morning about health care on the exchanges and rates for both the state's Avenue H and the federal healthcare.gov exchanges are going to cost a bit more in the coming year. What's the prognosis?
Well, the rates will be, and this is an average of all plans. It's not weighted by population, so it's not necessarily how much more all Utahns who are on the exchange will pay. But 5.7% the individual plans will be going up. The small business plans on Avenue H will, as an average, be going up 3.5%. Those individual plans will be a little more pricey if you're in a rural area. But, you know, those sound like, you know, healthy price hikes, and they are, but compared to what we used to have in the way of insurance plan price hikes, it's really quite modest.
Actually, we have a question that pertains to that on Twitter. How does 2015, the 5.7 increase, compare to pre-Affordable Care Act increases? And you're saying, well, that's actually less than it would have been.
Right. I mean, I think the average was 10%. They were going up, health plans were going up 10% on average per year for several years before Obamacare. But, you know, in some cases, of course, they were going up even higher, 20% a year. So it's a considerably slower rate of price increase. But it's still a price increase.
But it is still a price increase. Why are the rates going up? Do we know?
You know, I think just the rising cost of medical care insurance is always, you know, tracking that. It's cost insurance companies more to provide the care. So, you know, if I had the answer to that question, I suppose I'd be a rich woman. But anyway, it's tied to the rising cost of medical care.
So can consumers save money by shopping outside of the exchanges, or is this still the best deal around?
You know, I don't know the exact answer on that. I know that the state commissioner for insurance yesterday told a legislative task force that all consumers ought to be shopping around as much as they can. The thing is, the plans that are available on the exchange also have to offer it off the exchange, the same plan. So they'll see those, they'll see other offerings. I think they're all comparable. The thing about the exchanges, though, is if you are earning up to 400% of the poverty level, and if you're not in the coverage gap that gets no help, which is people below poverty level, anyway, you can get a subsidy, a tax credit, if you're earning up to 400% of the federal poverty level. So if you go by way of the exchange, you get your subsidies. So that's the key advantage there.
One of the end results, though, is that a complicated healthcare system is still complicated. I mean, the exchanges are on board, yeah. which is fine. Costs are going up but modestly, but it's still complicated. You have to educate yourself.
That's right. The Utah Health Policy Project and a bunch of other partners are in the middle or just beginning training a whole lot of navigators who will be providing free navigation, free help for people who need the help finding the plan. So, you know, there are a lot of community sources out there. One place to start would be the Utah Health Policy Project to get the help you need in figuring it all out.
Okay. Other news in healthcare this week, healthcare for the poor, and lawmakers got some more information on Governor Herbert's alternative to expanding Medicaid. It's called the Healthy Utah Program. He's been negotiating with the feds over it. What did we hear on Capitol Hill yesterday?
You know, we heard pretty much the same thing that Governor Herbert said last week after he ended the discussions with the Health and Human Services Secretary back in Washington. But anyway, essentially, they are 99% completed with their negotiations. They still have to write the language of the waiver that Utah will get for not expanding Medicaid. But we did hear a couple more details. The sticking point, for the most part, during the negotiations has been that Governor Herbert insisted that people who are able to work up to half the work or be in training to get work in order to receive a subsidy for their health insurance. HHS has resisted that, claiming it is not allowed in the law or for whatever reasons has resisted it. So they came to a compromise to call it a work effort. And Dr. David Patton, the head of the health department yesterday, told the legislators that how it will work is that those who sign up for subsidized health care will automatically be enrolled in the Department of Workforce Services for job training, job seeking help, whatever their particular need is. So it will be an automatic enrolling. The question is, will they be able to opt out of that? And he said, well, yes, they will be able to opt out, but the state isn't going to advertise that option.
So
that was kind of the key new piece of information we learned yesterday at the task force.
Well, Governor Herbert has to jump through the federal hoop. He has to sort of get HHS on board. He also has to get the state legislature. Did you get a sense that lawmakers were open to the Healthy Utah program, or are there some sticking points for them as well?
Well, you know, I think the work requirement morphing into a work effort will be a sticking point for some of them. You know, it just depends on the lawmaker. Person by person, the few that I talked to about it, you know, one said it's not a huge deal to him, and others said it might be a deal killer for him. They all want to hear the details of the plan from Herbert, or the plan that Herbert has hatched with HHS. And so a lot of them are reserving judgment until then. He's asked them to reserve judgment until they get the details. But that work requirement thing might be a deal killer for some. And some just want to wait. I mean, 21 other states are waiting. They're not doing Medicaid expansion or any alternative like Utah's contemplating. And so there are many who may just want to wait until it shakes out for a couple of years. I guess in 2017, the federal government is going to allow states more latitude, more flexibility in how they do this Medicaid expansion or not. So, you know, there will be some who will argue to wait. Mm. And, of course, that was sort of the thrust of a survey that the Sutherland Institute commissioned. Very complex topic, and reading these complex questions to people over the phone, they came up with more people supporting doing nothing than any other option. But even then, there were only 45% of the people saying that was their choice. Mm. So,
Georgia, anyway. What do you think about Healthy Utah? Is it going to gain steam as the legislative session goes on, or do you think it could fizzle, as Kristen is?
Well, I mean, excuse me, the governor's kind of in a tough spot because he's got to negotiate a plan with HHS through the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, the underlying theory of which is that the United States should join the civilized world. Every country in the civilized world takes access to health care for granted. Every country in the civilized world takes health care access for granted. We do not. And in Utah, the power structure is actively fighting the idea that health care access is a basic component of civilization. They're against it. They think it undermines individual freedom or individual initiative or something Stone Age like that. But the governor also is aware of walking away from, what is it, $250 million?
Is that right, Kristen?
Yeah, I think it's 258, but I think it changes every year.
Yeah,
so that was the last number.
And not only to not have that money to provide health care for people who otherwise wouldn't have it, but to pump that money into the economy, to reduce the amount of charity care and bill charge-offs that hospitals and doctors have to do all the time, to provide more jobs for doctors and nurses and orderlies and technicians and paperwork pushers at hospitals and clinics. I mean, that money all goes to that. It doesn't just vaporize. It goes into the Utah economy, and it turns over, and it provides jobs. But he's also got to face the legislature, who are scared to death at the prospect that, one, that Kenyan socialist might actually succeed something, and two, that those people might get a benefit that they wouldn't ordinarily have. The work requirement, maybe work effort, is a way to make that more palatable. And especially if it's sort of an opt-in, opt-out, making people aware of services that they might not have been aware of if they hadn't done that. In the same sense that when you go to get a driver's license, they ask if you want to register to vote. You know, it's a way to get you into the system without really any coercion. It's just a way to help people be aware of something that might help them.
Hmm. Kristen, what's the timeline? You said that Healthy Utah will likely get the HHS stamp of approval in the next week or so. Are lawmakers going to call a special session to consider this? Or are they going to wait until the January session begins? What's your sense?
Governor Herbert would like them to have a special session, and it is possible. Representative Jim Dunnigan, who's the co-chair of the Health Reform Task Force for the legislature, sort of the key guy in the ledge for this, he said it could go either way. He sees, you know, good aspects of having the special session and good aspects of waiting. I think the House leadership definitely wants to wait. A number of people want to wait until they see what all the demands on their on the state's resources are, so they can, you know, put this up against those. So my bet is there will not be a special session, that it will wait till the general session in the winter. But I could be wrong, because the governor may persuade them to do it earlier.
Okay, Kristen, thanks for your reporting. Health reporter Kristen Moulton, thanks very much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Let's move on to Utah Transit Authority, still under fire for another audit that was released last month. And officials were in the hot seat, I guess, on Capitol Hill this week. Lee, from your reporting, it sounded like they were on the offensive. Fill us in. What was their testimony?
Well, they are trying to defend themselves against some of the charges that were made against them by the auditors about sweetheart deals and high pay and shaky finances. And they have announced several steps to try to build public confidence in them. For example, Mike Allegra, who is the president of UTA, said that he would take a pay cut if a new study shows that he's overpaid. UTA has also announced this week that they are cutting the top bonuses that are available to executives from $30,000 a year down to $7,500 a year. Also, they nominated to become the new chairman H. David Burton, who's the former presiding bishop of the LDS Church. And he's seen as kind of a white knight, clean guy who can help build confidence in the agency.
Was he at the hearing the other day?
He was.
Before lawmakers?
Uh-huh.
And how did they receive him?
He didn't talk. He was just at the table. But when the members were asking for changes, they would address him and say, "Bishop Burton, you know, you need to build you need to build public confidence in this agency."
Interesting.
So,
the pay part of this, that's gotten a lot of public attention and scrutiny. The bonuses, the salaries. So they said they're willing to have their pay cut?
They said that they will follow the auditor's suggestion to look. They have always done a study every year that they claim shows that they are paid appropriately. the auditors say, the problem is you're only looking at base salary. You're not looking at the bonuses and all of the other perks that you receive. And if you add that in, you're overpaid. Huh. And so Michael Allegra said, okay, we're going to do the study the way you want it. And one member of the committee said, well, what happens if that shows you're overpaid? Will you take a pay cut? And he says, I will take appropriate pay.
Okay. One other big red flag in the audit was that the financial future of UTA. UTA is overextended. If sales tax revenue dips, they're in big trouble. Did the lawmakers talk about that at all? And how did UTA say they were going to sort of address their future prospects?
Well, it wasn't talked about much,
really?
Surprisingly.
Okay.
But they did get a commitment from UTA leaders to say that they will always operate in the black, that if they need to cut service to make ends meet, they'll cut service. They'll do what they need to do not to go in the red. However, the audit shows that for the next several years, they're going to be dipping into their reserves. And as the chairman of co-chairman of the committee up there, Kevin Van Tassel of Vernal, said, if anything bad happens in the economy, you don't have much wiggle room. Mm. You're in trouble. Mm. And Michael Allegra and others said, we know that, but we think we're okay, and we'll do whatever we need to do. We'll stay in the black.
Okay. George, in an editorial this week, UTA must restore the public trust. But you've got these bus cutbacks. You've got the audit. They are in trouble.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is one of those things where when you hear somebody say that government ought to be run like a business, UTA, in many senses, is run like a business in the worst way that businesses run. I mean, they grafted onto this public agency the worst aspects of private enterprise, excessive pay, executive salaries that boards just rubber stamp, insider dealing, people who know, who get inside information on where something's going to be built and trade off of it. That's Wall Street. That's not Main Street. That's not the Capitol. And so what they ought to be doing is getting away from this idea of running it like a business and run it like a public agency. They are largely dependent on sales tax revenue. It did take a dip during the recession. That's part of the problem that they've been facing. They did cut back on bus services for the hotel maids and the auto mechanics in order to build up the tracks for the bankers and the entrepreneurs and the editorial writers. And because trains are sexy and people like trains and people ride trains and Front Runner has Wi-Fi and all this kind of stuff. But the bus service for the average Joe who's got to get to work has been cut back. And even when it wasn't cut back in terms of routes, the hours really weren't all that good. You know, a metropolitan bus system that cuts off at 11 o'clock doesn't help people who do shift work at hospitals and things like that. It cuts off too soon. The train to the airport starts too late and ends too early for a lot of people who have to catch early or late flights. They need to build that back, and they are going to need more money. They probably need a sales tax increase in order to run the kind of service that this metropolitan area deserves. But to go and ask for a sales tax increase when all the publicity is about bonuses, high pay, cutbacks in service, sweetheart deals, the legislature wouldn't even pass a bill that would allow UTA to ask the cities, to ask the voters, if they could raise the sales tax. The voters would have the final word. The legislature wasn't even willing to start that process with the scandals out of UTA.
Hmm. Lee, is that what you are hearing on the Hill still? I mean, is there still a reluctance to give them more of a revenue stream?
Yes. In fact, the legislator who pushed the bill that George just talked about is named Johnny Anderson. He is the co-chairman of the Interim Transportation Committee, and he told UTA this week, I like transit. I think you need an increase in funds, but it's not going to happen right now because you're your own worst enemy, and you need to build public trust, and you need to turn things around, or we can't move forward with this.
What did Allegra say to that?
Just listened. But they did outline, what steps they're taking, and they vow to implement all of the reforms that auditors want. However, the other co-chairman of the committee, Kevin Van Tassel, said, well, I'm going to order or ask for another audit in a year just to make sure that you implement all of them.
So the scrutiny continues for UTA.
Can I ask you a question here?
Please.
Hey, George, when a lot of that news broke about that
negative audit, the Salt Lake Chamber took out that full-page ad praising the Utah Transit Authority. How do you explain that? Why is
it was a total coincidence. The chamber had a meeting that day, I think their annual meeting, where they gave a lot of awards to the business of the year and the, I forget what they all were. They had several awards. They do it every year. They had set this quite a ways in advance. I don't know if they had announced who the winners were going to be or they just told the winners so they'd come to the banquet, but they were there. And then right after that, Allegra and some other people from UTA had to, you know, put the award in the trunk of their car and run up to Capitol Hill and get dressed down by the legislators when the audit first came out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the page one, UTA is in a lot of trouble. Full page ad on page five or seven or whatever it was, UTA is wonderful. And there were a lot of letter writers and a lot of online commenters who noted that. I'm afraid there were a few of them who don't understand the difference between a news story and an ad. The chamber bought and paid for that ad. That was the chamber. That wasn't us. But, yeah, the irony was not lost on a lot of people.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. You can join us as well. The number 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Send us a tweet to the hashtag TripTalk. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. And joining me today, Lee Davidson, Brian Maffley, and George Pyle, all of the Salt Lake Tribune. And we're talking about the week's top stories. You can join us by sending a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. You can put your comments at sltrib.com or call us, 801-355-TALK is that number. Brian, let's bring you into the conversation. Big news in the Recapture Canyon case. Charges were filed against five people who participated in an off-road protest. Before we get to the charges and what happened this week, fill us in on that protest. What happened?
Sure. It needs a little bit of background. There are longstanding tensions in San Juan County between the local residents and political leaders and the Bureau of Land Management. They go back decades, really. And the two big sore issues are roads and artifacts and archaeology. And those two things come together in Recapture Canyon, a lovely canyon just east of Blanding, and a favorite destination for people who enjoy motorized recreation and hiking and horseback riding too. And the many of the locals in Blanding, particularly County Commissioner Phil Lyman, have been very unhappy with the BLM for taking so long to consider their petition for a right-of-way to reopen or reestablish motorized use in this canyon. It's
been illegal. You can't ride ATVs. You can't drive your Jeeps that area.
Since 2007. And what prompted that closing was the discovery of a illegally constructed trail that clearly damaged some archaeological sites. And under a lot of pressure from environmental community, the BLM district manager made a decision that the canyon should be closed to motorized recreation. There's trails on the rim, and you know you can still ride those, but in the canyon, for about a 10-mile stretch, starting at where the canyon crosses Highway 191 north of town. It's right below Recapture Reservoir for several miles downstream. Leah Hogston and I have hiked the trail that's a photographer from the Tribune, before the protest, and the trail is still there, and it just kind of winds up and through the creek and on the benches, and it's a lovely hike, really. And so what happened was the commissioner started talking about having this protest ride back in February or March, and it kind of gained a lot of momentum, and it turned into a protest against the BLM's control of the landscape. BLM, the federal government, controls, what, maybe 93% of the land in San Juan County. And there's a feeling that they're locking the public out. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that, no, the public's not locked out at all. But from Phil Lyman's perspective, yes, we don't have the access that we would like to have. That prompted this protest. It was occurred on a Saturday, May 10th.
How many people showed up again?
Well, I would say a few hundred showed up at a rally in town that morning, including some of these self-styled militia members who were kind of, transferring their that energy that was built up at Bunkerville, Nevada, over the Clive and Bundy situation. Even Bundy's son Ryan came. And there was a lot of speeches made before the ride, and those speeches now are factoring into these criminal charges. They're part of the alleged conspiracy, quote unquote, that these five local men face.
Okay, so protesters, they ride through this restricted area on ATVs. Five are charged this week. So if we fast forward to now, who are they?
Yeah.
Were there only five riders during this protest?
No, there were many, many more than that. My count was at least 50. It's probably more. And they chose the five. It was Phil Lyman and four others, all local men. One of them is the son of James and Jeannie Red, two of the defendants in the controversial artifacts case of 2009. The Red family since moved to Washington County, so they don't live in San Juan County anymore. But they were among those who rode into the canyon, many more were charged. So, the U.S. Attorney, Carly Christensen, has indicated that this is an ongoing investigation. It suggests to me that there will be more charges forthcoming, and many in the environmental community were kind of disappointed that they were charged with they were not charged with resource damage, only with operating a motor vehicle in a restricted area.
And then you mentioned something about conspiracy.
Yes, and so there was one count of that and one count of conspiracy, and that's where things get a little slippery here. And I was really kind of surprised to see that, because the acts that they call part of the U.S. attorney's calling part of a conspiracy is dangerously close to speech. It started when Phil Lyman published an op-ed piece in a newspaper that talked a lot about his love of the canyon, his sadness that has become such a flashpoint of controversy. And kind of at the end, he says, oh, by the way, we're going to have a little ride in the canyon. We'd love it if people are welcome to join us. That apparently is part of a conspiracy, according to the U.S. attorney. And then he promoted the event on his Facebook page and sat down for some interviews on the canyon rim with another local man who got charged, named Monty Wells, who's a local blogger, very much a partisan in the recapture debate. And they sat together talking, and Monty Wells posted this video on his website. And that is part of the conspiracy charge against him. And in the case of Jay Red, he gave a speech before the ride talking about his father, James Red, who was a beloved figure in Blanding, who took his life shortly after he was arrested in the artifacts case. That was 5 years ago. Dr. Red's death is a very traumatic event for the town of Blanding, and Phil Lyman himself had referenced the rough treatment that he felt that the BLM meted out on his friends and neighbors in Blanding as one of the reasons why he wanted to do this ride. So the shadow of Dr. Red was kind of all over the place there that day, and so now the U.S. attorney is claiming that speech Jay Red gave was, quote unquote, instructing and encouraging these people to do this illegal act of riding their ATVs into the canyon. I would like to point out that Jay himself was a passenger on a Jay Wren. It was a passenger on an ATV.
And he was not the driver.
He was not the driver. And when I saw him, I was looking for him because I wanted to chat with him. And he came riding in, and I walked beside him for a minute. And then he realized, wow, we're in the closed part of the canyon. And he got out immediately, and we started. And it seemed to me, I don't know if this is a fact, but it seemed to me that he wasn't his purpose to do anything illegal that day. Mm-hmm. And then we walked along and chatted about his family's they have a couple lawsuits pending against the BLM over the death of his dad. We talked about that.
Since the charges were filed, have you been able to talk to the five, Commissioner Lyman,
no.
Mr. Red?
Yeah, Commissioner Lyman chose not to talk to me. I reached him. He didn't want to talk. So normally he loves to talk to the press. I've been trying to reach Jay. He hasn't called me back. The other three gentlemen, I don't know. Monty Wells is a local blogger. The other two gentlemen are named, I got to remind myself, Shane Marion and Franklin Holiday. They're both local men. Mm. I don't know what they did to prompt the conspiracy charge against them.
Hmm. And as you mentioned, this is all happening within the context of Cliven Bundy and the dispute over public
yes.
lands and energy development versus conservation. I mean, there's
a lot
of tension.
Yeah.
How are folks in rural Utah reacting to the charges? Do you have a sense?
I'm not sure yet. I think, people were kind of divided in Blanding before the riots. There was obviously a lot of support. A lot of people turned out for that rally. But then there were others who felt that Phil Lyman was making a big mistake, including two former county commissioners I talked to, Lynn Stevens and Mark Maryboy. Both were very displeased, and for different reasons, about this ride into the canyon. On Maryboy's part, it was more of, it seemed disrespectful to the tribal communities that are a significant part of the San Juan community. And for Lynn Stevens' point of view, it was it seemed like this action would set back the county's efforts to get a right-of-way reestablished in that canyon. So I think, when people do civil disobedience, they are opening themselves up to a criminal charge. So it's hard, this is part of being a protester, is exposing yourself to these kind of things. However, I don't think they thought a conspiracy charge was in the mix. A citation for driving in a restricted area, yes. And I would like to add that Phil Lyman he felt that what he was doing was perfectly legal. Yeah. He made that really clear to everybody. There might wind up being a court battle over this. And it's also important to point out that 5 years earlier, a very similar ride was organized by local county officials in Kane County to ride up the Perea Creek. And the BLM was there, and nothing happened. There was no criminal prosecution at all. So I think this time around, they needed to make a statement that they can't tolerate these kind of protests, lest you just kind of invite more illegal ATV riding. Mm.
George, from the opinion page, do you think that this will help the conservationists? Will it help the public lands folks? What does it mean?
Well, it means we're going to fight about it some more. I mean, I think it's true that, one thing, if you're prosecuting and there's 50, 75 people out there, it makes sense to go after the ringleaders. It makes sense to go after the leaders. But not all of them actually rode in the canyon. Some of them, they were talking about it and encouraging people to come out and protest and express their views. But also, if you're going to engage in civil disobedience, if you're going to say, this law is unjust, I'm not only not going to obey this law, I'm going to go out of my way to break this law to show how unjust it is, part of the bargain is you get arrested and you go to jail. And by doing that, you gain attention for your cause, and you say, look, help, I'm being repressed. And you hopefully get more people come to your aid and see your point and say, what you're doing either isn't all that bad or it's actually good. It's actually right. And you do have the right to run through this public land. The BLM, which is in charge of this land, which is owned by all the people of the United States of America, says, no, you can't ride. You can walk in there, but you can't ride. You can't play with your toys in there, okay? They seem, a lot of people, you know, walking isn't good enough. They have to be able to take their big old honking ATVs in there, or their freedom is being taken away from them. Pressing charges, I mean, it comes right after Clive and Bundy, when nobody got arrested. There were lots of guns pointed at lots of people, and there are a lot of people saying, well, if you can't enforce the law, you know, what good are you? And they say, well, if we do enforce the law, shots will be fired and people will die, good guys and bad guys. We don't want to be responsible for that. So we wait until it's over. We wait until, you know, the tension is eased a little bit. We wait until nobody's standing there with guns. And then we file charges. And then the conservation community says, well, where have you been? And the other thing that we referenced in our editorial this morning is when Tim DeChristopher stands up in a BLM auction and we would argue selflessly tries to monkey wrench the auction because he's worried about the preservation of the earth, he goes to federal custody for 21 months. Now, it was a spur-of-the-moment thing, and he did try and fight the charges, and he did try and enter a necessity defense that they didn't even let him argue. But when people go out there and we would argue selfishly decide they want to play with their toys in a place where the federal government says you can't, they were looking like they were going to walk. And now we've had these charges. They're, you know, they're relatively minor charges, less than a year in jail, which usually classifies as a misdemeanor. So they're probably not looking at 21 months in federal custody, even if they're convicted of something. And so you still wonder, you know, is it fair? Do the people who act in defense of the earth get imprisoned, and the people who act in defense of destroying the earth get to walk?
We need to go to a break, but I want to slide in one sort of related news item. Governor Herbert announcing that a new monument in Utah is not imminent. At least he's getting that sense from President Obama's administration. How did he sort of characterize his conversation with the feds?
Yes, that's very much connected to the public lands initiative Congressman Rob Bishop is leading. And is hopefully, from Bishop's perspective, going to reach the finish line here in the next several months so he can introduce legislation that will resolve some of these longstanding land conflicts in eastern Utah. And apparently what the Obama administration has indicated is they will not use the Antiquities Act to designate a monument in Utah as long as that process is on track.
So if people are around the table, hands off.
Yes, and some counties are at the table, other counties are certainly not. Wayne, Garfield County, they don't seem very interested in participating. Daggett, Uinta, San Juan, Grant, they seem to be there, especially Daggett.
Okay, so where are we in the process? And if the Obama administration says we will not intervene while this process is underway, does that give proponents of a monument some sort of incentive to withdraw?
I think it gives them an incentive to. Are you talking about the proponents of the monument?
Yes.
Yes. It's the proponents of the monuments are actually very supportive of the public lands process. Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance in particular. They would like to see that process play out. And if it doesn't work, you better believe they're gonna press hard for a national monument around Greater Canyonlands. And that's not the only proposed monument. People kind of are forgetting to the south on Cedar Mesa. There are three different proposals for a monument there. And then we also have the San Rafael Swell in Emory County. Not as much, you know, organizing there, but, on the radar nonetheless.
Okay. Lots of public lands news. Brian Maffley from the Salt Lake Tribune talking about the week's news. And again, you're invited to chime in 801-355-TALK or put your comments at sltrib.com. We'll be right back after another quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And in studio this morning, Brian Maffley, Lee Davidson, and George Pyle. And again, you can join us 801-355-TALK. Some census data came out this week. Lee, do you feel richer?
Well, that's we should.
We should. Do you?
I don't, but we should feel richer. It shows that Utah's household income rose the third greatest in the country between 2012 and 2013. It's up 3.3%. The only places that were higher were Wyoming and Alaska.
Okay. Well, that I suppose that's good news, even if you don't feel it. What else came from the census data? Anything?
It's kind of an American snapshot. They release thousands of categories of data, but some other interesting ones are income equity is third best in the nation, meaning that there's not just a few rich people in Utah that get all the income. We spread it fairly evenly. And in areas of traditional families, we're tops in the nation again in a lot of things because we're kind of the epicenter of the Mormon culture. Such things as youngest overall age, biggest family size, percent of households headed by married couples, fertility, youngest age at marriage, all of those categories we're the best or worst, depending on your point of view.
So the numbers confirm what we've known for some time.
Right. But we are trending to become more like the rest of the nation over time, in part because more people who aren't LDS are moving in, and in part because LDS folks themselves are starting to mirror the rest of the nation.
Okay. Very good. Let's go to our underplayed story of the week, the, in case you missed it,
yes,
story, right? George, do you want to go first?
Well, as an election junkie and a bit of an Anglophile, I was up very late last night watching the returns on the BBC, which you can do now, of the Scottish independence vote. It was voted down like 55-45. In addition to all those wonderful British and Scottish accents and the reminder—
And the kilts. We've seen a lot of kilts.
And the reminder of the wonderful Monty Python election night special, which I put on my blog for those of you who miss it,
nice.
State of the Debate on sltrib.com. They settled a huge issue at the ballot box. No guns, no fighting, no bombs, no smuggled arms, no vote in the House of Representatives to support the moderate Scottish rebels. They went to the ballot box and they settled it. And it's still an ongoing controversy how much power should devolve from Westminster to Scotland, to Wales, to Northern Ireland. But they're settling it at the ballot box, and a wonderful example for the rest of the world.
That's great news. Lee Davidson, what's your pick?
Mine's more of an old story that's about to come to fruition. The legislature this year allowed expanding 80-mile-an-hour speed zones.
Okay.
And UDOT should be saying shortly, this week or next, where those are going to be in place. But even more fun is that bill allows urban areas to go up to 80 miles an hour. That's not expected, but they could go up to 70 or 75. So start your engines.
Okay. Very good. Brian.
For me, I would have to say water development is an ongoing concern here. The issues surrounding water made the paper a few times, but what we haven't been talking about much is the sales pitch the state government is building that we need to invest $32 billion in our water infrastructure because our resources are drying up. Now, a lot of critics are going to say, you know, there's a little bit of Chicken Little here. If we were just more intelligent about the way we use our water, we wouldn't need to dam more rivers or build more pipelines, which, you know, have a habit of wrecking in the environment and costing a lot of money. So I think what we've seen in the interim session this week is some suggestions, you know, kind of buttering us up for raising tax revenue and water rates to pay for this massive investment that the state says we need to make.
Okay, water, always a perennial issue here, and one that will certainly get a lot more coverage. I actually have a couple this week. One is about a hate poem. Did you read that story that Marissa Lang, our colleague, wrote? So there's this white supremacist. He writes this really violent, really graphic letter to a University of Utah professor. He is convicted for that threatening letter. But he says it wasn't a threat. He was just expressing himself. And this week, a federal appeals court agreed. He goes back to the district court now, and they'll decide if this is protected First Amendment speech. I think it's really intriguing. Mm-hmm. And it will be interesting to see like where the court draws the line between free speech and hate speech. I mean, if you read some of what Marissa, and apparently what he wrote was horribly graphic. We couldn't even put it in the paper.
And with blogs and tweets and all that kinds of stuff, you know, stuff that used to be private is now out there.
Yeah. So that's my first story. The second one, I think, is so sad. This young black man who was shot by police officers in Saratoga Springs, laid to rest yesterday. And, George, we've talked about this before. I mean, it's been a tough summer for various police departments. They've engaged in behavior that can be considered questionable. I mean, are we seeing a pattern not only nationally with the Ferguson stuff, but here in Utah?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's just a coincidence. Maybe it's just been a long, hot summer. But there have been more police shootings of apparently, if not totally innocent, at least unarmed, non-threatening bystanders, often in cases where the officer is white and the victim is black. And they're already start to release autopsy results that say people were shot in the back, people had their hands up. It's not as big a story. The national press hasn't picked up on it here as much as they have the Ferguson case because of just the way the media ignores the West, I guess. But it's
I actually wondered about the silence.
Yeah,
nationally.
And we're Ferguson fatigue, I guess, and they weren't ready for another one. But yeah, I mean the police are, and our hope is going to have to be posted with the district attorneys and the attorney general who will investigate this and hopefully tell us what happened.
Hmm. Here's the interesting part, and I guess the underplayed part of this story. Former Saratoga Springs Mayor Mia Love, she's running for Congress.
Yeah.
And of course, she's African American, and yet she's mum on this issue. I mean, do you think that this incident will have any political implications, or is it just going to die?
People are going to try. I mean, the Democrats, her opponents, are going to try and hammer her on this and try and get her to say something, partly because whatever she says is going to make somebody mad. I mean, either she's going to defend the officer, which is going to make her look too much like part of the establishment, or she's not, and she risks the Obama curse of being the angry black person.
Well, George, Darian's family keeps alleging that race had something to do with his death. Mm-hmm. What is the evidence for that, other than he's black?
Well, it happens often enough that when it happens to you, you assume that that's it. I mean, he was also carrying a sword.
A samurai sword.
Which was a toy, but you could argue that the officer didn't know that. And they're continuing to say, well, but he was shot in the back, and he wasn't a threat to anybody. They're going to have to investigate that, and I don't know that you're ever going to please everybody with the results of that investigation. But that's just the way it is. If there's a minority who's killed by the white establishment, there's always going to be that suspicion that if a white person were doing exactly the same thing, the officer would have just chuckled and gone on his way.
How can we ever know that, though?
We can't know that.
Yeah.
Well, cameras. Cameras, witnesses,
body cams.
Who knows?
That'll help.
Yeah. And they have obtained video from surrounding businesses, but they haven't. When I talked to them earlier this week, they hadn't looked at them yet.
I'm very interested to see what comes of that. George Pyle, Lee Davidson, Brian Mathley of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And we're going to wrap up this week with Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. And this week, he's giving some advice to aspiring writers.
It's one thing to talk to kids about something that you wanted to be when you were their age and you're living the dream that you had then. And another thing to talk to them about the disastrous decisions that you made that landed you in a newsroom. So I really had to think hard about it. And basically I said to myself, well, I'm just going to tell them the truth. And so in the column that I wrote, and this was in 1997, I wrote, first, you have to be a little crazy to be a writer. That may be a bit arrogant. After all, it takes a certain amount of ego to presume that reasonably intelligent people will stop what they're doing to read something you wrote, especially if you expect them to pay for the privilege. There are writers, and then there are writers. Tech, news, ad, fiction. There are lots of different kinds of writing. self-important yapping to the contrary, one type isn't more noble than another. When pressed, a good writer will try them all. Writers write, even when they don't publish. Basically, this means that writing isn't something you think about as much as it is something you do. It's hour after hour of trying to sensibly arrange on paper the stuff that doesn't really make sense in your head. Do it long enough and eventually it comes even when you don't want it to. Knowing how to write is less important than having something to write about. So see the world, get hurt, hurt somebody, bleed, forgive. All worthwhile writing is based on hope and loss. In other words, stuff you still want to do and stuff you wish you hadn't.
What was the look on the students' faces when you gave them this blunt truth of...
Well, you know, they had a chance to ask questions before it started. And so I kind of had an idea of who in the audience was thinking about becoming a writer or who was already jotting down, you know, little things at home with aspirations of becoming a writer. And it wasn't really, I think, what they wanted to hear. But I've actually met kids from that class. I mean, this was clear back in 97, and since then I've met a couple of them who have become writers. And they said, yeah, it worked out just exactly like you said. And a lot of people don't understand, if you're going to write, you should write about the sort of stuff that other people are trying to avoid, you know, and that's the nitty-gritty stuff in life.
It's your bread and butter.
Yeah, you join the army, have a kid, get divorced, you know, whatever. That's the fuel or the grist for being a writer.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, and you can find a lot more Kirby at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. The show is produced by the Salt Lake Tribune with technical support from Jesse Ellis and Tyler Ford. Thanks so much, guys. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great weekend.